Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Adrian Wooldridge talking about capitalism in America.
Thank you very much for that kind welcome, and really thank you all for coming here today. I know this is a very, very technical, difficult subject. Technical and difficult at the best of times, let alone on the hottest day of the year. And I know also there are other more interesting speakers you could be listening to at the moment. I know that because my wife is listening to one of them. As she told me in no uncertain terms that there are actually some quite interesting talks to go to. She doesn't want to hear this nonsense. However, I would say that the subject I'm going to talk about is the most important subject to understand. For the last 400 years, this has been the subject that holds the key to understanding what's going on in the world, and it also holds the key to what's going to happen in the world over the next 100 years. So intellectually, if for no other reason, you've made exactly the right choice. Every year, the world's most important business people and journalists and entrepreneurs and politicians gather together at the mountain ski resort of Davos in Switzerland. And I want you all to start off by imagining a meeting of the world's most important people four centuries ago in 1619. Imagine the scene when you've got Chinese princelings in their silk clothes, Turks in their kimonos and their kaftans and relevant clothes, the English buccaneers in their jerkins, and they're all there to discuss the most important question on everybody's mind, which is who is going to dominate the world in the coming centuries. And everybody there has a really compelling and interesting case to make. You have the Chinese. They say, well, surely it's going to be China. China is the world's biggest empire. It has the best navy. It has by far the best civil service, selected by rigorous examinations from the whole of this great continent. It has the world's biggest encyclopedia. It has a wall. It's got the ultimate secret of prosperity, a wall. And then a Turk stands there and says, no, it's going to be Turkey. We're the centerpiece of Islamic civilization. We're part of this huge array of Islamic countries stretching to Arabia and into Asia and beyond. We're spreading into Europe. We have Vienna in our sights. And then an Indian says, no, it's going to be in India. India is the most multicultural society in the world. It has more princelings from different religions, different races, all coming together in this sort of great cocktail of creativity. And then some eccentric British person comes along and says, no, no, it's going to be Britain. Britain is just about to separate itself from this sclerotic, ossified, useless continent of Europe. I was wondering if that would go down well. We have these magnificent, dynamic institutions. We have a parliament. We've invented the joint stock company. We have a fantastic navy. We're going to separate ourselves from Europe. We're going to dominate the whole of the world. Then you have a Spaniard who says, no, no, it's going to be Spain. We dominate the whole of continental Europe. We are spreading to Latin America. We have these huge sources of gold and particularly silver in Latin America. We have all this bullion. The future lies with us. So this is a very interesting, rigorous debate. And everybody actually has really quite a good case. And the problem is in this that nobody would mention the United States. The United States would be a complete irrelevance in this conversation. It's John Locke called it a tabula rasa. It's very lightly populated area of the world with a very sparse Aboriginal population, a few European settlements on the very peripheral coasts, but not very much. It's just a plaything of the European powers, the French and the British engaged in power politics. It really doesn't matter. The total GDP of the United States is probably that of a small German principality. It's irrelevant. And yet, if you look at the world today, the United States, which commands 5% of the world's population, produces 25% of the world's GDP. It's by far the biggest single economy, just in terms of pure heft. It's also the economy that is ahead of most of the most innovative industries, of the financial services industry, the biotech industry, the artificial intelligence industry, all these great companies that are shaping the future, such as Google and Amazon and the rest of them. They're all American companies, many, many, many of them based in California, the most American of the American states. I think when Reagan was president, America accounted for 10% of the world's patents. It now accounts for 20% of the world's patents. America accounts for 15 of the 20 top universities in the world. So it's, in many ways, an incredibly powerful, hegemonic economy. But I think there's a sort of sting in the tail of this amazing story of America rising from nothing to being this economic and political colossus. And that is that America is beginning to weaken. The rate of productivity growth in the United States is the slowest that it's been probably ever since the 1930s, certainly. America is seeing itself outperformed and outmaneuvered in a ever-widening range of industries by China, not just metal bashing and shoemaking and the rest of it, but also things like telecoms. The reason why there's such a fuss and such anxiety in the United States about Huawei is because they can see America threatening their dominance of a very, very important communications industry. America is no longer at the top of the sort of league tables that you want to be at the top of, such as the proportion of your people who go to university, the proportion of your people who are doing well in the PISA examinations for literacy and numeracy and the rest of them. But it is at the top of a number of very worrying sort of league tables, such as the number of your people who drop out of school without any qualifications, such as the proportion of your male population that is not engaged in the workforce whatsoever, and such as the number of opioid addicts. Massive, massive problem with opioid addiction in the United States. So there are a lot of red lights that are flashing. And so what I want to do in the next 40 minutes or so is to answer three questions. Firstly, why did the United States become the world's greatest economic power? Secondly, what are the causes of its current problems? And are those causes so profound that we're beginning to see the decline of America? Are we talking, you know, classically rise and fall? And thirdly, if it is the case that America is past its peak, what are the consequences for the rest of the world of a declining America? And I think those consequences are very, very profound and very worrying. But I want to start off by talking, you know, the first question, what made America great? Why did America go from this patchwork of lightly populated colonies into the world's greatest economic power? And the most obvious answer to that question is the sheer size of the country. I lived in America for 13 years, from 1997 till 2010, during the whole of the great evil New Labour dictatorship. I was exiled in the United States. And people said, what did you make of the country in all of those years there? And I just think, the one thing that I came away with, the one impression I came away with after 13 years, was that it's a big country. And that's just huge. It's on a sort of scale. It's very hard for the British and the Europeans to comprehend. And that size, you know, has shaped it in all sorts of very profound ways. It means that you can start an organization, start a company, and take it to a continental scale without ever going abroad. It means that you can import millions upon millions upon millions of people without ever really straining your social fabric. And that ability to bring people in really drove the growth, particularly in the 19th century. And it means that you can be rather careless about your country. You can be rather careless about its resources. So if you go to California now, you can see all these ghost towns, you know, which were built during the gold boom and then just abandoned. If you go to the Rust Belt now, you can see these towns, Detroit being a classic example, which have been abandoned because people have said, no, the future isn't here, the future lies in Texas, so we'll move to the Sun Belt. I think there was an article in the Times, in the Times of London, in the 1870s, which is talking about why it was that the Americans could build railroads so effectively, so quickly, and the British couldn't. And it said, well, that in Britain, it's a populated country, there's lots of people, they have vested interests, so that you have to build very, very higgledy-piggledy railroads. Whereas in America, they said, all you're doing is building a rail line from nowhere in particular to nowhere at all. And this ability, you know, to do that has made it, you know, it's quite rough on the country, but it does mean that you can grow very, very, very fast. So size is part of it. Size is a good explanation. But on the other hand, there are lots of other big countries in the world. Russia is a very, very big country. I think Russia has 6 time zones as compared with America's 3. And you wouldn't claim, even Putin, I think, wouldn't claim that Russia is an economic giant. Brazil is a very, very large country indeed, you know, but Brazil is a country. So what do they say about Brazil? That it's a country with a great future ahead of it and always will have. So I don't think just the size of the country works. And of course, obviously, you have somewhere like Hong Kong, which is a very small, compact place and incredibly economically dynamic place. So that's not a sufficient explanation. The second explanation is that it's just got an enormous range of resources. And it does have an enormous range of resources. You have mountains that are full of coal and iron ore and silver. You have, you know, citrus fruits in California and Florida. You have the grain bowl in the center of the country. You have Texas full of long-horn cattle. So you have all the resources that you need. And America is much less dependent on imports and exports than any other country in the any other rich country in the world. You know, it can be a sort of self-contained economy because there's nothing really that they need that they have to get from somewhere else. That's true of virtually no other country. So the resource explanation is part of it, but again, it's not sufficient. There are lots of countries with an incredible range of natural resources. Russia has an incredible range of natural resources, not a rich country. Saudi Arabia has, you know, the world's biggest oil supplies, and it is what it is, but it's neither a pleasant nor, in the long term, a sustainable rich country. And quite often, having a lot of resources can be more of a curse than a blessing because you become dependent upon those resources, you become captured by those resources, and your economy is distorted by those resources, so it makes industrialization much more difficult. So just resources in itself, again, is not a sufficient explanation. And I would say that fundamentally, the reason for this success is creative destruction. America has a higher tolerance for creative destruction than any other country in the world. And creative destruction is a phrase that was invented by the great economist Joseph Schumpeter in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy in 1943. And he says the characteristic of capitalism is these incredible gales of creative destruction which blow through the economy, flattening large amounts of stuff, but also leaving other stuff in its wake. And what creative destruction means, essentially, is the relentless ability to take resources from one place and put them in another place where they get better returns, where they're more creatively used. So you're shifting resources from the horse and the buggy to the motor car, from the pen and paper to computers, from landlines to iPhones and the rest of it. And America has always been more willing to engage in creative destruction than any other country. Most other countries worry that the cost of change might be too high. Most other countries take refuge in sort of airy-fairy cliches about the fact that you can get the benefits of creation without the costs of creation, without the destructive side of things. So you have Latin America has always been full of populist leaders who've said anything that goes wrong is because of evil capitalists or evil exploiters or even vested interests. Anything that goes right is because of us and our foresightedness. Europe thinks that you can, through a process of planning, through a process of control, get all the upside of capitalism, all the creative side, without the downside of capitalism, the destructive side. And, you know, you get lower growth as a result of that. America, I think, is the only big, rich country in the world which has said we're willing to take the downside, we're willing to take the destructive side, because we regard that as integral to the process of creation, that in a sense, creative destruction means destruction that is creative. It's the destruction side that drives the growth of the economy, just as much as the creative side. And America has made that sort of Faustian bargain much more happily than any other country. And I think that the extraordinary example of that is what happened between about 1865 and 1914, when you had, I think, probably the greatest growth of prosperity of any country in human history, with the exception of China over the last 40 years. And what you had was the creation of gigantic companies, continent-wide companies, Carnegie and Rockefeller and the rest of them. You had the creation of towns from nowhere, Pittsburgh and St. Louis and the rest, from nothing. You had a continent linked together by railways, which hardly existed at the beginning of that time. Then you get, at the end of that time, the rise of the motor car and the rest of it. I think in 1900, 14% of the world's rail traffic went through just one city, which is Chicago. So America really leaps ahead. It goes from being a pre-industrial agrarian society to being a society of skyscrapers, cars, telephones, and modern management and the rest of it. It's an extraordinary period of creative destruction. Now, there's an incredible cost to this in terms of gigantic fortunes, in terms of the destruction of the environment, in terms of the destruction of the poor old buffalo and all sorts of things, not to mention the indigenous Indian population, Native American population, an incredibly brutal process, but it is a process that leads to a massive improvement in living standards. So Carnegie and Rockefeller, for all their faults, reduced the price of steel and the price of oil by 90%, an incredible reduction in the price of the basic inputs into the economy. You have a country which it took at the beginning of that time about 6 months to get across the country from New York to California. By the end of that time, you can get across the country in a few days by rail. So a whole continent is brought together into a hyper-modern world, brutally but very, very quickly. It lays the foundations of a modern, wealthy society. So this willingness to accept creative destruction, to embrace creative destruction, is absolutely at the root of what makes America, America, what makes it prosperous. Now, the question is why? Why has America been more willing to accept creative destruction than any other country? I think one very important reason is that America was the first country to be created, the first big, serious country to be created entirely in the modern era. That most other countries were created under feudalism, under agrarianism, under a pre-modern regime. And think about the basics of a pre-modern regime. The pre-modern regime accepts essentially that children should do what their parents do. It accepts basically that growth should be low, should be tolerant, that too much change is bad, that continuity is a good thing. And it accepts as the price of all that stability, very low growth. So the pace of growth up until the mid-18th century is 11% a century. 11% a century. So basically, the world is static. Now, America is born in roughly the same year that Adam Smith publishes The Wealth of Nations. And what The Wealth of Nations says is that society shouldn't be static, it should be dynamic. What it says is that we shouldn't regard the pursuit of self-interest as something wrong and immoral that we should try and constrain through moral preachings of the church. He says that by pursuing your own self-interest, you can generate wealth for everybody. Society should go. It says we're not in a world of zero-sum competition. We're in a world of dynamic change in which by pursuing essentially business ends, you make everybody richer. And America is founded in the light of that insight and those ideas. So instead of having an a feudal class, an agricultural class, instead of having an established neo-feudal church, instead of having a whole set of attitudes which demonize money-making, which demonize change, which cling to the idea of a static society, they're there with all the accoutrements of modernity built into them. Secondly, another very important thing is the Constitution, which is written in the light of Adam Smith and John Locke's insights and the rest of them. And what the Constitution does is to set a very sharp limit on the power of government to intervene in people's lives. What it says is that the government can't confiscate your property because your property is yours by an inalienable right. The Constitution lays down certain rights which are inalienable, not just property, but intellectual property. So it says that the government must have a reason to act. And in some cases, the reason to act will never be greater than these inalienable rights. It also sets limits to the power of the government by creating a system of separation of powers with the Supreme Court and the Congress and the President. It puts all sorts of roadblocks on the power of government to interfere in people's lives and says, basically, you live your life according to these rights and the happiness will result. Happiness will be a result of that. And that's a very deliberate project by James Madison, who says, you know, what we must do is set faction against faction to limit the potential power of government. So I think that's a vital thing, the Constitution and the government. But what this doesn't mean is no government at all. America has never been a sort of purely libertarian society in which government plays no role. It's limited the power of government. It's told government what it can and can't do. But government has also been very, very important in its growth. The government was important in the 1930s in getting the country out of the recession, the Great Depression. It was important in the formation of Silicon Valley, which has much to do with military spending as it had with anything else. So government has played an active role. But what America has been very good at is using government to work with the grain of the market rather than against the grain of the market, using it as a sort of lever to make markets work more efficiently. So in the 19th century, the government really didn't do very much, didn't have very many powers except for one power, which was to give people land. Most of the land in the country belonged to the government. And what the government did was to say, you can have this land, you can have 280 acres or the rest of it, so long as you settle it and work on it and make it productive. So the government had in its hands more than the size of Europe in land, which it gave away, often creatively to settlers, sometimes slightly more dubiously to railroad barons. But what it did by giving away these parcels of land was to encourage this internal colonization of the country. Again, so giving away the land works within the grain of the market. And again, with the universities, what it tends to do is give grants to universities predicated upon scientific research, predicated upon peer-tested research programs. So again, the government is feeding in money into the basic factors of production, but it's not crowding other people out. So the government plays a limited but creative role. I think the fact that it's a nation of immigrants is incredibly important. If you think of the American great entrepreneurs like Carnegie, a Scotsman, Alexander Graham Bell, a Scotsman, Tesla, it's not all Scotsmen, Tesla, a Serbian, the man who invented fracking was the son of a it was the son of a Greek goat herd. So you've got this constant stream of people from other countries who are driving America's entrepreneurialism. The fact that it's a frontier society, the greatest American president in many ways, in my view, Teddy Roosevelt, was a frontiersman who writes a four-volume history of the American frontier. The great symbols of the 19th century are sort of railroad barons and cowboys and various other sort of colonizers. It's a frontier society that when the frontier finally closes in the 19th century, then shifts that emphasis on colonizing the frontier or reaching the frontier to reaching the frontier in new forms of technology. So always it's a frontier society that has been a great specialist in producing frontier firms, frontier innovators who invent the future. So immigration, frontiersmen, all very vital in this process of growth. But I would say two things are absolutely fundamental to why America is the pace setter for so much of economic history. One is entrepreneurs. America has been just much better at producing entrepreneurs on a mass scale than any other country in the world. And entrepreneurs are absolutely vital for creating historical change, historical progress. Entrepreneurs are the people who see the future in their bones, who feel the future in their bones, who see the future and bring it about, who bring that future about. They tend to be actually basically pretty crazy people. They're people who just have ridiculously huge ambitions and ridiculously huge belief in themselves. So somebody like Carnegie it just has this idea that we're seeing the fundamental basis of civilization changing. We're moving to a steel civilization, and I will do everything to this great god of steel. The same with Rockefeller. These tend to be rather unpleasant people, quite often. Rockefeller was most certainly a very unpleasant person. Henry Ford was an extremely unpleasant person who was also completely insane. Appalling views or you know, appalling anti-Semitism, racism, awful person, but he just had this idea, everybody in this country will be driving a motor car and I will do anything I can, regardless of any opposition, to bring this about. You have the same with Bill Gates, you have the same with Bezos, which is a sort of mania, a sort of entrepreneurial mania. And America has put that entrepreneurial mania at the very center of its society. So if you think of Britain, basically entrepreneurialism is a means to an end. People want to create wealth so they can essentially buy a nice big country house and live like a gentleman in the countryside and get rid of all of that mucky stuff about making money. They have that idea. That's what they want to be. So in Britain, the idea is to be a gentleman. In France, the idea is to be an intellectual. You want to sit on the left bank of the river smoking gitane and talking all sorts of complete rubbish. And that's what your ideal is. In Germany, you want to be a sort of scholar. That's the highest point you can be. And society channels its talent into these sort of areas. In America, the highest point you can be is to be an entrepreneur. You want to be an entrepreneur, and when you're a really successful entrepreneur, you don't sell your business and buy a country house. You keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger because you want to be the biggest entrepreneur in the world. There's nothing higher than that. And if you do a bit of philanthropy, you're not doing just philanthropy in order to make people better, improve their lives. You're doing philanthropy because you want to reinvent philanthropy. You want to turn it into the world's biggest, best organized sort of philanthropy. You want to impose your will on the world through your entrepreneurial powers. And that is absolutely central to America's culture, and it has produced more entrepreneurs, bigger entrepreneurs, better entrepreneurs than any other country in the world. Secondly, America has been a massive specialist in producing corporations, companies. And companies are the organizations which institutionalize entrepreneurship and keep it going to move it on to a new level. And there are so many companies in the world now that we tend to think of companies as being just part of the furniture of life, something that we don't even need to think about because they're so common. But in fact, the corporation is a very remarkable creation, a very unique historical creation, one of the most productive innovations the world has ever seen. Up until the early 19th century, there were two sorts of companies. There were joint stock companies, which got the privilege of limited liability just so long as they did something for the government, a government project. So they would conquer India in the case of the East India Company, or they would build a bridge, or they would build a canal. You couldn't get limited liability unless you did something for the government on the basis of a charter, which is granted by Parliament or by politicians of certain sorts. Or there were partnerships, and partnerships were much easier to create, much more fluid. They came and they went, but the problem with partnerships is they had unlimited liability. So if you went bankrupt, you were liable up to your cufflinks. And that meant that partnerships tended to be small. They tended to only involve people who knew each other, quite often relatives, cousins and the rest of it. And America was the first country to say, we want to give the privilege of limited liability to anybody who creates a company. So from 1800 onwards, America is mass producing companies for all sorts of functions. They don't have to go to politicians and say, we want to build this bridge, we want to do that. You can create a company for any purpose. So America, very rapidly, from the turn of the 19th century onwards, creates more companies than any other place in the world. And it also, because of the size of the country, it takes these companies to scale. It creates not just companies, just not millions of companies, it creates giants, gigantic companies, of which the biggest is Carnegie Steel. Carnegie Steel, in 1900, Carnegie Steel employed 250,000 people, at a time when the government, I think, employed 70,000 people, including postmen. It's just on a different level scale from any other organization, any other private sector organization the world's ever seen. When Carnegie sold Carnegie Steel to JP Morgan, it was worth one-third of all the money in circulation in the United States. So these just are gigantic organizations. So America, these two things are driving this process of creative destruction. Entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs, corporations created by these entrepreneurs and then made public. And finally, the final thing that America has on its side is an extraordinary ability to reinvent itself, which is applying creative destruction to its entire sort of society, to its entire business model. So you have, up until 1860, America is essentially two countries, two economies, based on two different visions of life. It's a capitalist, entrepreneurial economy in the North, and it's a slave society in the South, based on owning human property for the production of cotton. And in the early half of the 19th century, slavery actually becomes more entrenched, more popular, and more difficult to get round, because cotton becomes such an incredibly successful cash crop. So you're having these two societies diverging from each other, based on entirely one on free labor, one on slavery. And the slave society is sort of getting out of control. It's spreading to Kansas and the rest of it to satisfy this demand for this gold, this gold, you know, cotton crop, particularly for Lancashire and the rest of it. So eventually, Lincoln and the North say, we cannot be two houses divided against each other. We cannot have two societies based on two different principles. So they have the Civil War, and the Civil War basically destroys the slave economy of the South at enormous cost. I think the equivalent of 5 million people in modern terms, as a proportion of the population, are killed. That's a very ruthless war, which constitutes America as a fully capitalist country. In the 1930s, when you have the Great Depression, you know, the Great Depression is much bigger in America than almost any other country, and you have massive interference by the government, a massive breaking of traditional models of how the economy should be organized, a big shift from laissez-faire to something that's much more interventionist by FDR. And again, it's a willingness just to reinvent yourself. In some ways, as a big trade union, big business, big government sort of society. Then in the 1970s, you have the American economy fading very badly. So the car industry is being beaten to a pulp by the Japanese. The steel industry is being beaten to a pulp by the Japanese and the Koreans. The electronics industry is being beaten to a pulp by all of these people. So it looks as though industrial America is fading, is dying. And there's a lot of talk that the great center of power in the world will not be America, it will be Japan. Big shift of big Japanese mania at that time. And what happens at the end of the 1970s and the 1980s is a really ruthless re-engineering of the economy under the auspices of Reaganism, which shifts the emphasis from manufacturing to microcomputers and the rest of it, the financial services sector, which re-engineers a lot of the classic companies like the car companies and the steel companies, downsizes them, completely reorganizes them, makes them much more efficient. So you have a birth almost of a new capitalist economy. So America has repeatedly reinvented itself in a very, very ruthless way. And what strikes me is that the big question now is whether this can happen again. Because what we are seeing in the United States is that this great economic powerhouse is beginning to fade. As I started off with a few facts, let's have some more. The rate of company creation in the United States is at the lowest point that it has been since the late 1970s. The labor force participation of males in the United States is one of the lowest in the world. The opioid addiction, obviously, a gigantic problem. You're seeing whole industries being captured by the Chinese. And you're seeing America visibly beginning to fade, which is why Donald Trump, whose name I haven't mentioned so far, but you'll hear some more about Trump, which is why Donald Trump talks about Make America Great Again and got millions and millions of people voting for him. You can imagine the admission that America, which has always regarded itself as the greatest country in the world, suddenly is saying, you know, Make America Great Again. The American life expectancy, having gone up relentlessly throughout this period, has now begun to go down. Life expectancy, particularly life expectancy for white males, is going down now in the United States. So there are extraordinary number of signals that are flashing red. And the question is, can America get beyond this? Can it reinvent itself now as it did in the 70s and the 30s and the 1860s? There are some reasons for thinking that it can. One is this ruthlessness, which has been applied in the past and isn't being applied now. The second is a sort of the entrepreneurial thing, which I talked about at great length, is still just as vigorous now as it was in the late 19th century. If you think of the world's greatest entrepreneurs, they're all American. And you have people like Bezos, not all American, but mostly American. You have people like Bezos, you have people like Gates, who are doing exactly what the robber barons did, which is to be reinventing society on the basis of some new technology. So you had the steel, society being reinvented on the basis of steel in the 19th century. Now it's being reinvented on the basis of silicon. And as a result of that, you're getting these gigantic world-beating companies, which keep on getting better in many ways. But I'm still very worried. One reason I'm worried is that I think America's appetite for creative destruction is going down. That people, if you go into a McDonald's in the United States, it's that this coffee may be hot, it might burn you. These are not the people who, who colonize this massive, very fearsome, very worrying continent. You know, there's a sort of culture of risk aversion, a culture of litigation, which is weakening the sort of moral fiber of the country. So there's a sort of fear of that. The amount of social mobility is at historic lows, not just upward mobility, but also geographical mobility, that Americans are much more likely than at any point in their history to die within a few miles of the place where they're born. So you get this sense of a very timorous society that it's not churn, it's not creative destruction, it's actually, let's not have anything to disturb our happiness, and if anybody tries to disturb us, we'll sue them. Secondly, the big companies, the giant companies, are becoming too dominant. That they're becoming so big that they're destroying potential competition. The Economist, for which I work, we did a survey of American industry, and we found that in 3/4 of American industries, competition over the last 10 years had been reduced. Basically, you see, in area after area after area, 2 or 3 big companies completely dominating the economy, their respective industries, and squeezing out everybody. If you've ever had the misfortune to go on an American airline, you can see what that does. It creates very lazy, greedy incumbents. And you can see it in Silicon Valley, which is supposed to be the sort of crucible of American creative destruction. I used to go to Silicon Valley a lot in the 1990s, and it was a place that consisted of small companies, of entrepreneurs. Everybody wanted to start a company. Everybody wanted to be the next Bill Gates. Everybody thought of themselves as this huge entrepreneur. And if they didn't like the people they were working for, they'd get in their car, drive down the road, and start working for somebody else. Massive entrepreneurial creativity. Now, it's a place that's dominated by 5 companies. Those 5 companies regulate, rule everything. Everybody who's young, who's an entrepreneur, basically wants to creates a product which they can sell to those companies. Those companies buy those products. Quite often they kill those products because they regard them as rival products. They buy them in order to kill them. And you don't just drive from one company to another. You're very concerned about keeping your reputation with Facebook, your reputation with Amazon. You know that your future lies with your reputation with these people. You sign non-disclosure agreements. So you have, essentially, a small number of companies completely dominating the industries of the future. And that is not good. That's not creative destruction. And if you look at all these people, they all have massive government departments. They're all very, very close to the government. I used to work in America, in Washington, from 2000 to 2010. Almost everybody I work with there who's a journalist is now working as a PR flack for one of these massive companies. Everybody I knew who worked for the Obama administration is working as a PR flack for one of these companies. That is the sign of a very decadent form of capitalism, crony capitalism, capitalism that is not embracing creativity, capitalism that just wants to regulate itself. So when the appalling, in my view, disgusting Zuckerberg goes on about, oh, we must regulate Facebook more, what he means is we must regulate it in such a way that there's no competition and that there is the standard for the rest of history. So it's becoming rent-seeking rather than truly creative capitalism. So I'm more worried than I have been for a long time. Then there's a lot of other things. The American entitlement system is badly thought out, badly designed. People retire too early. They get too much money on their retirement. There's not enough money put in education. We're subsidizing old retirees at a huge rate whilst not investing in young people. By we, I mean they. So the entitlement system, very, very badly designed. Huge numbers of people, because of the weird disability system they have, just leaving the labour force and becoming perpetually dependent on disability payments, which means they can't get back into the labour force because they get that money through a different federal scheme. So a badly designed government, and above all, the one thing that's always saved America when things are going badly, as in the 1930s, as with the Civil War, is really creative intervention by the government. And what we have now in the United States is a government that's more dysfunctional than we've ever seen before. We have Trump, who is a dangerous and malign figure. We have a Democratic Party that's shifting rapidly towards the sort of woke left and to a world of unrealistic promises and actions. You don't have anybody who really has a creative solution to the problems of capitalism. You have a lot of people who have a lot of very bad solutions, either protectionism and nationalism on the one hand, or sort of soft socialism on the other hand. So the one thing that America needs to shake it out of its problems, a creative government that can bring these companies down to size, that can break up some of these companies if they need to be broken up, is completely dysfunctional and is creating more problems than it is providing solutions. So I think the likelihood of America being in significant decline is very high, which brings me to my very last point, which is, so what? I'm sure many people think, great, this is a bad country, it's a malign country, it's done all sorts of bad things in the past, genocide of the Indians, slavery, bullying, thuggishness, Donald Trump, you name it. You know, there's a lot of reasons to be worried about America. But I would submit that America has done more good than harm, that we wouldn't have beaten Russia in the Second World War, that we wouldn't have beaten Russia in the Cold War had it not been for the United States. We would not have beat Hitler in the Second World War had it not been for the United States. That after the Second World War, the United States created a sort of global liberal order, which was a basis of stable growth for the world, and that has been basically a good thing. And that what we're going to see with the decline of the United States is three very worrying things. One is the disappearance or decline of a global hegemon. And whenever you see a global hegemon declining, you get, as an automatic result of that, more competition, more uncertainty, and a greater threat of war. And the classic example of that is what happened with the decline of Britain, when the British economy just wasn't big enough to support a far-flung global empire and all the military commitments that it had, and you had a serious challenge from Germany. And all that challenge from Germany, because we couldn't control Germany, couldn't contain Germany, was the First World War. And I think we may well see exactly the same thing with the rise of China, that China is playing the role that Germany played before the First World War, and America's capacity to control China is going down. And as China becomes bigger and more powerful, and as America becomes weaker, the likelihood of having a repetition of the First World War becomes much bigger. I would say the overwhelming likelihood is that within the next decade or so, we have some sort of significant war with China. Secondly, what happens when you get a country weakening is you get it retreating from the world. The last time America retreated from the world and became a very introverted country was between the First and the Second World War, when America basically stopped taking part in the international financial system. It put up barriers to immigration. It pursued a policy of American first nationalism, make America great again, between 1918 and 1939. No immigration, basically, an inward-looking economy. And the result of that for Europe was catastrophic, because it led to recession, It led to turmoil because the British economy simply wasn't big enough to play the hegemonic role, but America wouldn't play the hegemonic role. So you just got chaos. You just got, and eventually the rise of Hitler. And I think that's very likely. What we're seeing between the 1920s and the 1930s is exactly what we're seeing now with Trump. 1920s in America, booming economy ends in bust. Now we have a fairly fast-growing economy, which I think will end in bust in the United States, and an unwillingness to take your bigger role in the world. So I think the likelihood of conflict with China, the likelihood of massive systemic instability in the world because of the decline of America is much bigger. So I think the decline of America is a bad thing. And I think finally there's an issue of values. Again, whatever you think of the sort of values America has supported, they are Western values. They're values of individualism, they're values of competition, they're sort of a fairly humane set of values. I think what we're going to see as China becomes more powerful and more important in the world is a very, very different set of values, which are much more hostile to individualism, which are much more prone to being willing to engage in really worrying biological, genetic, eugenic experiments, which again are going on in China at the moment. So the more America declines, the more the sort of values which will dominate the world will be the values of the Chinese and to some extent the Russians, which are not liberal values, which are in many ways anti-liberal values. So I think the extent to which when America declines, we're going to miss it, is going to be massive, both in terms of the spread of really unpleasant values and in terms of massive global instability. But the greatest book written about sort of the future in the 19th century, I think, is Tocqueville's book, Democracy in America. And when Tocqueville is writing Democracy in America, he says really two things. One is that the future is America. This is what we have to study to understand what the future is, and that the values of the future are the values of modernity. They're the values of individualism, liberalism, democracy. They're essentially the values of France and Britain on a bigger and more democratic scale. And I think if you had a current Tocqueville writing a book on the future, it wouldn't be Democracy in America. It would be something about on the grounds of authoritarianism in China. China is the country that's becoming bigger and more powerful. China is the face of the future, and it's not democracy that they're marshalling. It's a sort of authoritarian, top-down, intrusive surveillance capitalism. So with that, I hope, inspiring thought, I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.